a critical juncture in my career, after I left Starwood Hotels and Resorts, the company that owns such brands as the W Hotel and the Westin. I was adrift. For the first time in my life, I couldn't lay claim to a title or a job. I had to reassess my mission. I had come to Starwood from Deloitte to accept what was an irresistible offer: to be the youngest chief marketing officer in a Fortune 500 company, a goal I had set myself 3 years earlier, and reinvent the way an industry thought about marketing. But my new job didn't go exactly as planned. Jürgen Bartels, the president at Starwood, who recruited me, promised to mentor me and pave my way toward becoming a future leader of the company. My goals for the company were large and required changing an entire company's way of thinking. Up until that point, marketing in the hospitality industry was a regional affair, often left to individual hotels. But the cost of that arrangement was a lack of company-wide brand consistency. Our plan was to consolidate our marketing functions under one roof with a global outlook. Rather than allow each of our regions around the world to set their own individual marketing strategies, I wanted to centralize our marketing operations more in order to clarify our message and create greater impact in the marketplace with a cohesive brand. After all, our primary customers, business travelers, were increasingly global and expected consistency. Shortly after I was hired, however, Jürgen Bartels left the company. Corporations, like any bureaucracy, tend to resist change, especially when the change doesn't have the support of top management. It became clear a year into my job that under the latest president, I wouldn't be able to garner the kind of support within the company I needed for such a radical reorganization. The new president made it clear that we would not be moving forward with our plan to reorganize the marketing department. The writing was on the wall for the plan, and for me personally. Without the go-ahead needed to make the kind of bold decisions that I felt would ultimately lead to company success and a more senior personal position, I knew I wouldn't be able to reach my goals here. I was shocked. I left work early that particular day and jogged mile after mile through the beautiful paths of New York's Central Park. Exercise has always been a refuge where I do some of my best thinking, but some 10 miles later, I was still in shock. The next morning, as I walked into the office, I knew that my future was somewhere else. All the accoutrements of a top executive's life, the large, cushy office, the mahogany furniture, the corporate jet, the fancy title on the door, meant nothing if I couldn't implement the ideas that made work fun, creative, and exciting. I officially resigned soon after, and if I hadn't, I know I wouldn't have been long for the company anyway. It was time for me to establish a new goal. Should I seek out another position as chief marketing officer, proving myself by building bigger and better brands, striving for greater revenue and profits, and helping to turn a company into a brand icon? Or should I set my sights even higher? My ultimate goal was to become a CEO. But it seldom happens for those in marketing. I had spent the greater part of my career convincing top management that marketing can and should directly influence all operating activities, yet I was not responsible for all of them. To truly define the brand, the ultimate marketing job was to be the CEO. If I chose the latter direction, what else did I need to learn to become CEO? What were my chances of getting such a job? What sacrifices or risks were involved? Honestly, these questions weren't clear to me at the time. In the wake of my disappointment, after years of go, 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 I felt lost. I needed to figure out what I wanted to be all over again, and I was scared. For the first time in ages, I had no company to attach to my name. I loathed the thought of meeting new people without a clear explanation for what I did. Over the next few months, I had hundreds of conversations with the people I trust. I took a Vipassana meditation retreat, where I sat for 10 hours each day, for 10 days straight, in silence. For a guy like me who can't shut up, it was torture. I wondered if I might fritter away all my time thinking. I wondered if I should go back to Pennsylvania and find a smaller pond to inhabit. During that time, I wrote a detailed 12-page mission statement, asking such questions as, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What are the various industry opportunities available to me? I listed the venture capitalists I wanted to meet, the CEOs I knew, the leaders I could turn to for advice, and the companies that I admired. I left all my options open: teacher, minister, politician, chief executive officer. For each potential new direction, I filled out a networking action plan. When everything was laid out, I reached out to my personal board of advisors. I didn't have the qualifications to be appointed a CEO with a major corporation. Yet when I looked inside myself, that was exactly what I wanted to do. Sitting down with Tad Smith, a publishing executive and one of my best friends and advisors, I was told I had to get over the prestige of working for a Fortune 500 company. If I wanted to be CEO, I had to find a company I could grow with. It was exactly the advice I needed to hear. I had been too focused on big companies. While the dot-com crash had made entering the digital world a whole lot less palatable, there were still some very good companies in need of business fundamentals. Now, I knew this was where I needed to look, and I began refining my action plan. From that day on, many of the calls I made, and the meetings and conferences I attended, were aimed at finding the right small company to call home. 3 months later, I had 5 job offers. One of the people I reached out to was Sandy Kleiman, a well-known Hollywood player who once served as Michael Ovitz's right-hand man at Creative Artists Agency, and who then ran an L.A.-based venture capital firm called Entertainment Media Ventures. I had gotten to know Sandy during my time with Deloitte, when I was exploring paths into the entertainment world. Sandy introduced me to the people at a company called Yaya, one of the investments in his firm's portfolio. Yaya was a marketing company pioneering the creation of online games as advertising vehicles. They had a good concept and the strength of committed employees and founders. They needed a bigger vision to get the market's attention, some buzz for their then unknown product, and someone who could use all that to sell, sell, sell. In November 2000, when the Yaya board offered me the CEO position, I knew it was the right fit. The company was located in Los Angeles, and it offered the sort of unconventional route into the entertainment world I had been looking for, and a chance to bring my experience as a marketer to the CEO job. If Virginia can do it, you can too. A few months ago, a friend of mine told me about a woman named Virginia Feigles, who lived not too far away from where I grew up. He had been inspired by her tale of triumph. Hearing her story, I felt the same way. At 44, Feigles decided she no longer wanted to be a hairdresser. She wanted to be an engineer. From the get-go, there were naysayers, people who insisted it couldn't be done. Their negativity simply provided more fuel for her fire. "I lost a lot of friends during this whole thing," Feigl says. People become jealous when you decide to do what no one thought you would or could. You just have to push through. Her adventure reads like a Cliff's Notes guide to career management, where a bold mission and a commitment to reach out to others combine to create opportunities previously unavailable to a high school graduate. It also conveys a harsh dose of reality. Change is hard. You might lose friends, encounter seemingly insurmountable obstacles, and face the most troubling hurdle of all, your own self-doubt. Feigl's had always planned to go to college. Raised by a single mother in small-town Milton, Pennsylvania, the opportunities were slim. She was married by 17 and pregnant a year later. She worked full-time as a hairstylist in her husband's salon and raised her only son. 20 years went by. With her second divorce, Feigl's rethought her life. Growth, she reflected, came only from change, and change came only from new goals. She was working part-time as a secretary at the Chamber of Commerce when she realized life had more to offer. "I just thought, this is stupid. Why am I on the wrong end of this? Not everyone who has a Ph.D. in physics is Albert Einstein." While it's true not every engineer is a genius, they all know algebra, something Feigl's couldn't claim. So she buckled down and learned the subject within a few months. After a summer stint at community college, she decided to apply to a top-tier civil engineering school at Bucknell University. The associate dean, Trudy Cunningham, didn't sugarcoat the situation. "When she arrived, I told her that life was about to get hard. She's an adult with a life, an apartment, a car, and she was competing with kids who were living in dorms and having their meals cooked." Luckily, Feigl's had always been an avid connector all her life. She was a member of a number of community organizations, serving on the boards of the YMCA, Milton Chamber of Commerce, and Parks and Recreation Committee. She also had stints serving as president of the Garden Club and the Milton Business Association. She had supportive friends and advisors all around. For the other students, the end of class meant keg parties and football games. For her, it meant a night working at the salon, followed by grinding study sessions. Feigl's doesn't remember a day she didn't think of quitting. She remembers getting back her first physics test. She failed. "Another student thought it was the end of the world. I told her not to worry. I wasn't about to commit suicide," she recalls, with the wry insight reserved for someone who's been through it. She ended up with a C in the class. Many sleepless nights and several C's later, Feigl's found herself among 137 other engineers in the graduating class of 1999. No one was more astonished than the graduate herself. "I just kept on thinking, what have I done?" And then repeating to myself, "I've done it. I've actually done it." With her goals completed, her network has grown, and not only in terms of friends and new business contacts. Today, she's newly married to her former boss at the Chamber of Commerce, and busy with a budding career at the state's Department of Transportation. Recently, she became chairperson of the Planning Commission, where she used to take notes as a secretary. Reaching your goals can be difficult, but if you have goals to begin with, a realizable plan to achieve them, and a cast of trusted friends to help you, you can do just about anything, even becoming an engineer after the age of 40. Connectors Hall of Fame Profile. Bill Clinton. Know your mission in life. In 1968, when William Jefferson Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University, he met a graduate student named Jeffrey Stamps at a party. Clinton promptly pulled out a black address book. "What are you doing here at Oxford, Jeff?" he asked. "I'm at Pembroke on a Fulbright," Jeff replied. Clinton penned Pembroke into his book, then asked about Stamps's undergraduate school in his major. "Bill, why are you writing this down?" asked Stamps. "I'm going into politics and plan to run for governor of Arkansas, and I'm keeping track of everyone I meet," said Clinton. That story recounted by Stamps epitomizes Bill Clinton's forthright approach to reaching out and including others in his mission. He knew, even then, that he wanted to run for office, and his sense of purpose emboldened his efforts with both passion and sincerity. In fact, as an undergraduate at Georgetown, the 42nd president made it a nightly habit to record on index cards the names and vital information of every person whom he'd met that day. Throughout his career, Clinton's political aspirations and his ability to reach out to others have gone hand in hand. In 1984, when he was governor of Arkansas, he attended for the first time a national networking and thought leadership event called Renaissance Weekend in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Clinton secured an invitation through his friend Richard Riley, who was then governor of South Carolina. Attending Renaissance Weekend was like a trip to a toy store for a guy like Clinton, who wasted no time meeting others and making friends. Here's how a Washington Post article from December 1992 describes Clinton in action at the event. "Many guests reflecting on Clinton's presence remember images more than words, how he would roam from discussion to discussion and take a spot at the side of the room, leaning casually against the wall, how he would seem to know everyone, not just from their name tags, but remember what they did and what they were interested in. He hugs you," said Max Heller, the former mayor of Greenville. "He hugs you, not only physically, but with a whole attitude." What Heller is referring to is Clinton's unique ability to create an almost instantaneous intimacy with whomever he's talking to. Clinton doesn't just recall your personal information, he uses the information as a means to affirm a bond with you. From Clinton, two lessons are clear. First, the more specific you are about where you want to go in life, the easier it becomes to develop a networking strategy to get there. Second, be sensitive to making a real connection in your interactions with others. There is almost an expectation among us that whoever becomes rich or powerful can be forgiven for high-handed behavior. Clinton illustrates how charming and popular you can become and remain when you treat everyone you meet with sincerity. Chapter 4. Build it before you need it. Mitch Albom wrote, "Build a little community of those you love and who love you." Forget the images we all have in our heads of the desperate, out-of-work individuals scooping up every business card in sight while fervently mingling at business conventions and job-hunting events. The great myth of networking is that you start reaching out to others only when you need something like a job. In reality, people who have the largest circle of contacts, mentors, and friends know that you must reach out to others long before you need anything at all. George, for example, is a smart guy in his 20s who was introduced to me through a mutual friend. George worked in public relations in New York and aspired to start his own PR business. He asked me to lunch one day looking for advice and encouragement. 10 minutes after we sat down, I knew he was on the wrong track. "Have you started to reach out to potential clients?" I asked. "No," he told me. "I'm taking it step by step. My plan is to work my way up in my current company to a point where I can afford to leave. Then I'll incorporate, get an office, and start searching for my first customers. I don't want to start meeting with potential clients until I can present myself as a credible PR person with my own firm. You've got it totally backwards, I told him. You're setting yourself up for failure. My advice was to start finding future clients today. Had he thought about what kind of industry he wanted to specialize in? Had he thought about where the top people in that industry hang out? Once he could answer those questions, the next step was to go hang with this new circle of people. The most important thing is to get to know these people as friends, not potential customers, I said. Though you're right about one thing, no matter how friendly you are, if the people you approach are any good at what they do, they won't hire you right off the bat to do their PR, which is why you should offer your services for free, at least at first. For instance, maybe you can volunteer your time to a nonprofit organization they're involved in, or aid in publicizing a school fundraiser their kids are involved in. But won't my employer be angry at my expending so much energy on other things? George asked. Doing good work for your employer comes first, I told him. Finding time to manage your outside work is your responsibility. Concentrate on an industry that your present employer doesn't service. Remember, if you haven't done the necessary legwork on the day you decide to open your own business, you'll be back at your old job in no time flat. So I should work for these people for free? Absolutely, I said. Today you are unproven, and breaking in is tough. Eventually you'll have a growing circle of people who have seen your work and who believe in you. That's the kind of connections you're looking to create if you're going to start a business, or if you're looking to change jobs or careers. At some point, while you're still working for your current employer, start looking to turn one of your contacts into a real paying client. Once you've got an established client that will provide references and create some word of mouth, you're halfway home. Then, and only then, is it time to go back to your company and ask to go half-time, or better yet, turn them into your second big client. If you quit at that point, you've hedged your bets. You have a group of people who will help transition you into a new career. The last half hour of our lunch was spent thinking about all the people he already knew who could help him get started. I offered a name or two from my own network, and George's confidence started to soar. I'm confident that now, when he reaches out, his interactions won't be tainted by desperation. He'll be looking for ways to help others, and everyone can benefit from a little bit of that. The ideas behind starting a business aren't that different from the ideas that will make you a hot commodity within your company, not to mention give you job security. I know that's hard to believe given the current job environment. According to a recent study of business school programs, the percentage of MBAs in 2004 who were without a job 3 months after graduation tripled from the year before to an alarming 20%. Scores of people are out of work or living in dread that the axe will fall on their heads. A blizzard of pink slips has convinced job seekers that they must do more than scan the Help Wanted ads or send resumes. Too often we get caught up efficiently doing ineffective things, focusing solely on the work that will get us through the day. The idea isn't to find oneself another environment tomorrow, be it a new job or a new economy, but to be consistently creating the environment and community you want for yourself, no matter what may occur. Creating such a community, however, is not a short-term solution or one-off activity only to be used when necessary. The dynamics of building a relationship is necessarily incremental. You can only truly gain someone's trust and commitment, little by little, over time. Right now, there are countless ways you can begin to create the kind of community that can help further your career. You can, 1. Create a company-approved project that will force you to learn new skills and introduce you to new people within your company. 2. Take on leadership positions in the hobbies and outside organizations that interest you. 3. Join your local alumni club and spend time with people who are doing the jobs you'd like to be doing. 4. Enroll in a class at a community college on a subject that relates to either the job you're doing now or a job you see yourself doing in the future. All of these suggestions will help you meet new people, and the law of probability ensures that the more new people you know, the more opportunities will come your way, and the more help you'll get at critical junctures in your career. My first year in business school, I started consulting with my friend Tad Smith, who is now president of the media division at the large magazine publishing company Reed Business Information. The idea wasn't to create a sustainable consulting company that we would run after school. Instead, we wanted to offer our knowledge and work ethic to small companies for cut-rate prices. In exchange, we'd learn about new industries, gain real-world skills, and have a list of references and contacts when we graduated, as well as make some ready cash. What about the world you inhabit right now? Are you making the most of the connections you already have? Imagine for a moment that all your family and friends and associates are part of a garden. Take a stroll through that relationship garden. What do you see? If you're like most people, you see a tiny parcel of cleanly cut grass that represents the usual suspects of an ordinary Rolodex. It consists of your immediate friends, co-workers, and business partners. The most obvious people. Your real network, however, is an overgrown jungle with an infinite variety of hidden nooks and crannies that are being neglected. Your potential for connecting is at this moment far bigger than you realize. All around you are golden opportunities to develop relationships with people you know, who know people you don't know, who know even more people. There are a number of things that you can do to harness the power of your pre-existing network. Have you investigated the friends and contacts of your parents? What about your siblings, your friends from college and grad school? What about your church, bowling league, or gym? How about your doctor or lawyer or realtor or broker? In business, we often say that your best customers are the customers you have now. In other words, your most successful sales leads come from the selling you've already done. The highest returns don't come from new sales. They come on top of the customer base you've already established. It's easy to reach out to those people who are at least tangentially part of your network. The big hurdles of networking revolve around the cold calls, meeting of new people, and all the activities that involve engaging the unknown. But the first step has nothing to do with strangers. You should start connecting with the people you do know. Focus on your immediate network. Friends of friends. Old acquaintances from school and family. I suspect you've never asked your cousins, brothers, or brothers-in-law if they know anyone that they could introduce you to help fulfill your goals. Everyone from your family to your mailman is a portal to an entirely new set of folks. So don't wait until you're out of a job or on your own to begin reaching out to others. You've got to create a community of colleagues and friends before you need it. Others around you are far more likely to help you if they already know and like you. Start gardening now. You won't believe the treasures to be found within your own backyard.
Chapter 6.
Chapter 5. The Genius of Audacity. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe wrote, "Seize this very minute. What you can do, or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power and magic in it." My father, Pete Ferrazzi, was a first-generation American, a merchant marine sailor in World War II, and an uneducated steel worker whose world was hard hours and low wages. He wanted more for me, his son. He and I were inseparable when I was growing up. His friends called me Repeat because he took me everywhere with him. He knew I would have a better life if he could help me find a way out of our working-class heritage. But my dad didn't know the exits. He'd never been to college. He knew nothing of country clubs or private schools. He could picture only one man who would have the sort of pull that could help me. His boss. Actually, the boss of his boss's boss, Alex McKenna, CEO of Kennametal, in whose factory my dad worked. The two men had never met. But Dad had a clear sense of how the world worked. He'd observed, even from the plant floor, that audacity was often the only thing that separated two equally talented men in their job titles. So he asked to speak with McKenna. McKenna, upon hearing the request, was so intrigued that he took the meeting. In the course of the meeting, he agreed to meet me, but nothing more. It turned out that McKenna liked me, partly because of the way I had come to his attention. He served on the board of a local private elementary school, the Valley School of Ligonier, where all the wealthy families sent their children. By reputation, it was one of the best elementary schools in the country. Strings were pulled, and Mr. McKenna got us an appointment with Peter Messer, the headmaster. The day I enrolled in the Valley School, on scholarship, I entered a new world that set me on an entirely new course, just as my father had hoped. Over the next 10 years, I got one of the best educations in America, starting with Valley School, then Kiske School, Yale University, and on to Harvard Business School. And it would never have happened if my father hadn't believed that it never hurts to ask. As I look back on my career, it was the single most important act in my life. Moreover, the lesson I learned from my father's action, like no other, informed all that I have done since. My father simply couldn't be embarrassed when it came to fulfilling his family's needs. I remember once we were driving down the road to our home when Dad spotted a broken big-wheel tricycle in someone's trash. He stopped the car, picked it up, and knocked on the door of the home where the discarded toy lay waiting to be picked up. "I spotted this big-wheel in your trash," he told the owner. "Do you mind if I take it? I think I can fix it. It would make me feel wonderful to give my son something like this." What guts! Can you imagine such a proud working-class guy approaching that woman and essentially admitting he's so poor that he'd like to have her garbage? Oh, but that's not the half of it. Imagine how that woman felt, having been given the opportunity to give such a gift to another person. It surely made her day. "Of course," she gushed, explaining that her children were grown and that years had passed since the toy had been used. You're welcome to the bicycle I have, too. It's nice enough that I just couldn't throw it away. So we drove on. I had a new big wheel to ride and a bike to grow into. She had a smile and a fluttering heart that only benevolence breeds. And Dad had taught me that there is genius, even kindness, in being bold. Every time I start to set limits to what I can and can't do, or fear starts to creep into my thinking, I remember that big-wheeled tricycle. I remind myself how people with a low tolerance for risk, whose behavior is guided by fear, have a low propensity for success. The memories of those days have stuck with me. My father taught me that the worst anyone can say is no. If they choose not to give their time or their help, it's their loss. Nothing in my life has created opportunity like a willingness to ask, whatever the situation. When I was just an anonymous attendee at the Davos Economic Forum in Switzerland, I walked onto a hotel bus and saw Nike founder Phil Knight. Knight was like a rock star to me, given his extraordinary success at creating and building Nike, and the many marketing innovations he introduced over the years. Was I nervous? You bet. But I jumped at the opportunity to speak with him, and made a beeline for the seat next to his. Later, he would become Yaya's first blue-chip customer. I do this sort of thing all the time, whatever the situation. Sometimes I fail. I've got an equally long list of people I've attempted to befriend who weren't interested in my overtures. Audacity in networking has the same pitfalls and fears associated with dating, which I'm not nearly as good at as I am the business variety of meeting people. Sticking to the people we already know is tempting behavior, but unlike some forms of dating, a networker isn't looking to achieve only a single successful union. Creating an enriching circle of trusted relationships requires one to be out there, in the mix, all the time. To this day, every time I make a call or introduce myself to people I don't know, the fear that they might reject me is there. Then I remember the big wheel my father gave me, and push ahead anyway. Most of us don't find networking the least bit instinctive or natural. Of course, there are individuals whose inherent self-confidence and social skills enable them to connect with ease. Then there are the rest of us. In the early days at Yaya, I was worried for the company's survival. For the first time in my career, I had to reach out to a lot of people I didn't know, representing an unknown company, pushing a product that was untested in the marketplace. It was uncomfortable. I didn't want to cold call executives from BMW and MasterCard and pitch them my wares. But you know what? Pushing to get into BMW was not that difficult when the alternative was laying off a bunch of my staff or failing in the eyes of my board and investors. Mustering the audacity to talk with people who didn't know me often simply comes down to balancing the fear I have of embarrassment against the fear of failure and its repercussions. For my father, either he asked or his family didn't have. For me, I either ask or I'm not successful. That fear always overrides my anxiety about rejection or being embarrassed. Ultimately, everyone has to ask himself, or herself, how they're going to fail. We all do, you know. So let's get that out of the way. The choice isn't between success and failure. It's between choosing risk and striving for greatness, or risking nothing and being certain of mediocrity. For many people, the fear of meeting others is closely tied to the fear of public speaking, a fear that consistently beats out death as the one thing we dread most. Some of the world's most famous speakers admit to feeling similar anxiety. As Mark Twain said, "There are two types of speakers, those that are nervous and those that are liars." The best way to deal with this anxiety is to first acknowledge that our fear is perfectly normal. You are not alone. The second thing is to recognize that getting over that fear is critical to your success. The third is to commit to getting better. Here are a few things you can do today to make good on that commitment and get more comfortable at being audacious in social situations. Find a role model. We're predisposed to seek out people like us. Shy people tend to congregate with other shy people, and outgoing people congregate with outgoing people. Because they unconsciously affirm our own behaviors. But everyone knows that one person within their group of friends and associates who seems to engage others with little or no fear. If you're not yet ready to take the big leap of addressing new people on your own, let these people help you and show you the way. Take them with you, when appropriate, to social outings and observe their behaviors. Pay attention to their actions. Over time, you'll adopt some of their techniques. Slowly, you'll build up the courage to reach out by yourself. Learn to speak. Many businesses have responded to the nearly infinite number of people who recognize they need to become better speakers. These educational organizations realize you're not looking to give speeches to an audience of 1,000 people, at least initially. Most people who come to them for help are looking to gain self-confidence and some trusty tools for overcoming shyness. They don't offer one or two simple quick-fix cure-alls. What they do is a chance to practice in a non-intimidating environment with an instructor who can guide and push you. There are hundreds of coaches and schools devoted to this type of training. One of the most well-known is the Toastmasters Club. They're sure to have a local chapter in your area. It is a well-run organization that has helped millions of people hone their speaking skills and overcome their fears. Get involved. You'll feel most comfortable when you're doing something you enjoy with others who share your enthusiasm. Any hobby is an opportunity to get involved. Stamp collecting, singing, sports, literature. Clubs develop around all of these interests. Join up. Become an active member. When you feel up to it, become one of the leaders of the group. This last step is crucial. Being a leader in life takes practice. So practice. The possibilities for making new contacts and reaching out to others will grow and grow. Get therapy. I know. You're probably thinking, he wants me to go to therapy to become better at talking to people. Let me explain. 1. I think merely acting on the desire to be better than you are now, no matter the venue, is a very important commitment. 2. Some of the most successful people I know have been to therapy at one point in their lives or another. I'm not suggesting therapy will make you a better people person, but it might help you address your own fears and social anxieties in a more productive way. Many studies funded by the National Institute of Mental Health report a high success rate using counseling to alleviate the conditions that normally inhibit a shy person. Just do it. Set a goal for yourself of initiating a meeting with one new person a week. It doesn't matter where or with whom. Introduce yourself to someone on the bus. Slide up next to someone at the bar and say hello. Hang out at the company water cooler and force yourself to talk to a fellow employee you've never spoken with. You'll find that it gets easier and easier with practice. Best of all, you'll get comfortable with the idea of rejection. With that perspective, even failure becomes a step forward. Embrace it as learning. As the playwright Samuel Beckett wrote, "Fail, fail again, fail better." Fear debilitates. Once you realize there's no benefit to holding back, every situation and every person, no matter how seemingly beyond your reach, becomes an opportunity to succeed. The Madam of Moxie. When it comes to improving your speaking skills, no one is better than Deanne Rosenberg. A 32-year career counselor and owner of her own management consulting firm, Deanne Rosenberg, Inc. Rosenberg is the Madam of Moxie, and for good reason. In 1969, she read a Wall Street Journal article that noted the absence of a female voice in the American Management Association. They were interviewing the then president of the AMA, who was quoted as saying, "We haven't found a woman who can speak authoritatively in public about management," Rosenberg recalls. She cut the article out and sent a letter to the AMA, telling them to look no further. 2 weeks went by, and her letter went unanswered. "Well, that wouldn't do," she snaps. "I wrote another letter straight to the president, effectively telling them to put up or shut up." 2 days later, the president of the association called to say that they had scheduled her for a lecture. Deanne went on to become the first woman to speak on behalf of the AMA. The lesson from that fateful series of events remains with her. The recipe for achievement is a medley of self-assuredness, dogged persistence, and audacity. Encounters of the audacious kind, as Deanne learned, are what successful careers are built on. In her many years teaching others to overcome their fears, she's created a time-tested script that anyone can use when meeting someone for the first time. I found the script helpful. I think it can help a lot of you as well, and I gratefully offer it to you here. 1. State the situation. You go right in and hit them with how you see it in the cold light of day, without being too inflammatory or dramatic, says Rosenberg. She made it clear to the AMA that A, having no women speakers was wrong, and B, hiring her would be a step in the right direction. It makes sense that before you can speak persuasively, that is, before you speak from a position of passion and personal knowledge, you need to know where you stand. 2. Communicate your feelings. We downplay the influence of emotions in our day-to-day contacts, especially in the business world. We're told that vulnerability is a bad thing, and we should be wary of revealing our feelings. But as we gain comfort using "I feel" with others, our encounters take on depth and sincerity. Your emotions are a gift of respect and caring to your listeners. 3. Deliver the bottom line. This is the moment of truth when you state with utter clarity what it is you want. If you're going to put your neck on the line, you'd better know why. The truth is the fastest route to a solution. But be realistic. Why, new Phil Knight of Nike wasn't going to buy anything based on 1 5-minute conversation on a bus at Davos. I did make sure to get his email and tell him that I'd like to follow up with him again sometime. Then I did so. 4. Use an open-ended question. A request that is expressed as a question, one that cannot be answered by a yes or no, is less threatening. How do you feel about this? How can we solve this problem? Can we meet up again sometime soon? The issue has been raised, your feelings expressed, your desires articulated. With an open-ended suggestion or question, you invite the other person to work toward a solution with you. I didn't insist on a specific lunch date at a specific time with Phil. I left it open and didn't allow our first exchange to be weighted down by unnecessary obligations. Chapter 6. The Networking Jerk. Edmund Burke said, "Ambition can creep as well as soar." He is the man, or she is the woman, with a martini in one hand, business cards in the other, and a pre-rehearsed elevator pitch always at the ready. He or she is a schmooze artist, eyes darting at every event in a constant search for a bigger fish to fry. He or she is the insincere, ruthlessly ambitious glad-hander you don't want to become. The networking jerk is the image that many people have when they hear the word networking. But in my book, this breed of hyper-Rolodex builder and card counter fails to grasp the nuances of authentic connecting. Their shtick doesn't work because they don't know the first thing about creating meaningful relationships. As I learned the hard way. If you knew me as a younger man, you may not have liked me. I'm not sure I liked myself that much. I made all the classic mistakes of youth and insecurity. I was pretty much out for myself. I wore my unquenchable ambition on my sleeve, befriending those above me and ignoring my peers. Too often, people put on one face with their subordinates, another with their boss, and another one yet with their friends. When I became responsible for marketing at Deloitte, I suddenly had a lot of people reporting to me. I had some very big ideas about what I wanted to do, things that never had been done from a marketing standpoint in the world of consulting. And now, finally, I had a team with which to execute them. But instead of viewing my employees as partners to be wooed in achieving my long-term objectives and theirs, I saw them as called upon to carry out my tasks. Add to this my young age. I was 20 years younger than any other member of the executive committee, and you can understand why the resistance among my staff was holding all of us back. Tasks that I thought should have taken hours ended up taking days. I knew I needed to do something, so I reached out to an executive coach, Nancy Bador, who had been coaching high-level CEOs before there was a name for such thing. The day of our first meeting, sitting in my office, we barely had a chance to exchange pleasantries before I blurted out, "What do I need to do to become a great leader?" She looked around my office for a few moments and said nothing. When she finally spoke, it struck me to the core. Keith, look at all the pictures on your wall. You talk about aspiring to become a great leader, and there's not one picture in your whole office of anybody but you. You with other famous people, you in famous places, you winning awards. There's not one picture in here of your team or of anything that might indicate what your team has accomplished that would lead anybody like me to know that you care for them as much as you care for yourself. Do you understand that it's your team's accomplishments and what they do because of you, not for you, that will generate your mark as a leader? I was floored by her question. She was absolutely right. Had I shown the genuine concern I had for the lives my employees led outside of work? Why hadn't I made an effort to make them part of the leadership? I'd been doing it with my bosses from day one. I realized then my long-term success depended on everyone around me, that I worked for them as much as they worked for me. Politicians understand this in a way too few executives grasp. We vote for the people we like and respect. Great companies are built by CEOs who inspire love and admiration. In today's world, mean guys finish last. My friend and author Tim Sanders taught me there are two reasons for the end of the era of mean business. First, we live in a new abundance of choice in business, in everything from products to career paths. Choice spells doom for difficult colleagues and leaders. At a time when more of us have more options than ever, there's no need to put up with a product or service that doesn't deliver, a company that we don't like, or a boss whom we don't respect, he writes. The second reason is what he calls the new telegraph. It's almost impossible for a shoddy product, a noxious company, or a crummy person to keep its, his, or her sad reality a secret anymore. There are too many highly opinionated and well-informed people with access to email, instant messaging, and the web. The bottom line is, if you don't like someone, it's easier than ever to escape him. When you don't have others' interests at heart, people will find out sooner rather than later. Our culture demands more of us these days. It demands that we treat each other with respect, that every relationship be seen in mutually beneficial terms. When you look back upon a life and career of reaching out to others, you want to see a web of friendships to fall back on, not the ashes of bad encounters. Here are a few rules I can suggest from personal experience to ensure you never become a networking jerk. 1. Don't schmooze. Have something to say and say it with passion. Make sure you have something to offer when you speak, and offer it with sincerity. Most people haven't figured out that it's better to spend more time with fewer people at a one-hour get-together and have one or two meaningful dialogues than engage in the wandering eye routine and lose the respect of most of the people you meet. I get emails all the time that read, "Dear Keith, I hear you're a good networker. I am too. Let's sit down for 15 minutes and a cup of coffee." Why? I ask myself. Why in the world do people expect me to respond to a request like that? Have they appealed to me emotionally? Have they said they could help me? Have they sought some snippet of commonality between us? I'm sorry, but networking is not a secret society with some encoded handshake practiced for its own virtue. We must bring virtue to it. Two. don't rely on the currency of gossip. Of course, using gossip is easier. Most people lap up such information, but it won't do you any good in the long run. Eventually, the information well will run dry as more and more people realize you're not to be trusted. 3. Don't come to the party empty-handed. Who are the stars of today's internet world? Bloggers, those freewheeling cybernauts who set up sites and online journals to provide information, links, or just empathy to a community of like-minded individuals. They do it for free, and they're often rewarded with a devout following of people who, in return, offer as much as they receive. It's a loop. In connecting, as in blogging, you're only as good as what you give away. 4. Don't treat those under you poorly. Soon enough, some of them will become overlings. In business, the food chain is transient. You must treat people with respect up and down the ladder. Michael Ovitz, the famed Hollywood super agent, was said to be a master networker. A scathing and relatively recent Vanity Fair profile, with dozens of anonymous and not-so-anonymous sources taking shots at the man, was a very public expression of a dazzling career that had gone somehow horribly wrong. People asked, "What happened?" Ovitz has some amazing interpersonal skills, but he wielded them disingenuously. People he no longer needed, he treated with indifference, or worse. It wasn't surprising that these same people not only reveled in, but may have also contributed to his fall. 5. Be transparent. "I am what I am," the cartoon character Popeye used to say. In the information age, openness, whether it concerns your intentions, the information you provide, or even your admiration, has become a valuable and much sought-after attribute. People respond with trust when they know you're dealing straight with them. At a conference, when I run into someone I've been dying to meet, I don't hide my enthusiasm. "It's a pleasure to finally meet you. I've admired your work from afar for quite some time, and been thinking how beneficial it might be if we could meet one another." Coy games may work in a bar, but not when you're looking to establish a deeper, more meaningful connection. 6. Don't be too efficient. Nothing comes off as less sincere than receiving a mass email addressed to a long list of recipients. Reaching out to others is not a numbers game. Your goal is to make genuine connections with people you can count on. I'm embarrassed by the way I learned this lesson. I had always heard that sending out holiday New Year's greeting cards was a good idea. So I began a practice when I graduated Yale to send a holiday card to everyone in my contact database. By the time I was at Deloitte, the list was thousands of people long, and I was hiring temp help to address and even sign the cards at year's end. Well, we can all see this coming. The intention was good enough, until a college roommate noted, actually jibed, how appreciative he was to get not one, but actually 3 cards 1 year, all with different signatures. It's not about mass. It's about a real connection. If you're not making friends while connecting, best to resign yourself to dealing with people who don't care much about what happens to you. Being disliked will kill your connecting efforts before they begin. Alternatively, being liked can be the most potent, constructive force for getting business done. Connector's Hall of Fame profile. Catherine Graham, 1917-2001. Cultivate trust in everyone. Tragedy transformed Catherine Graham from wife to publisher overnight. She took over the Washington Post in 1963 after the death of her husband, Philip Graham. Her shy and quiet demeanor seemed unfit to deal with the demands of one of the most important newspapers in the country. Graham proved everyone wrong. She helped to build one of the great newspapers and most successful businesses in America. During her era, the Post published the Pentagon Papers, took President Nixon head-on over Watergate, and ruled Washington's political and media scene in a style that was inimitably her own. In fact, it was this style that is her most lasting legacy. Running the Post with compassion, kindness, and sincerity, Graham became a powerful figure. Graham's influence gave her an ability to empower others, from the highest echelons of society to its lowest, with a sense of dignity and respect. Richard Cohen, a columnist for the Washington Post, wrote the following a few days after Graham's funeral. On a beastly July Sunday some years ago, I returned to Washington from the beach and took a taxi to the parking garage across the street from the Washington Post where I kept my car. A tent had been erected on the Post's own parking lot. It was for a company party, given for people whose names you never hear, those unbylined, non-TV-appearing types, who take the ads, or deliver the paper, or maybe just clean the building. In the heat, I saw Catherine Graham plodding toward the party. She was old by then, and walking was difficult for her. She pushed her way up the ramp, moving in a laborious fashion. She had a farm in Virginia, a house in Georgetown, an apartment in New York, and most significantly, that hideously hot day, a place on the water in Martha's Vineyard. Yet here she was, incredibly, I thought, doing the sort of thing vice presidents for smiling do in other companies. Analyze the life of Catherine Graham, and one inescapable theme emerges. Despite a lifetime free from financial worry and a social status bordering on royalty, she made friends with everyone, not just those who could assist her newspaper or augment her position within the Beltway. Most reports on her funeral mentioned celebrity names like Henry Kissinger, Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Tom Brokaw. But you don't have to do much heavy lifting before you find an extensive list of non-celebrity attendees. Here's a sampling. Irvin Kalogden, a Fairfax County special education teacher who founded a student breakdancing team with a $350 Washington Post grant. Rosalind Stiles, from the Frederick Douglass Early Childhood and Family Support Center, for which Graham had helped raise money. Henrietta Barbier, of Bethesda, a woman retired from the Foreign Service, belonged to a weekly bridge club of about 60 women at the Chevy Chase Women's Club. She said Graham never missed a session. She was bright about the game, and she took lessons, and she was serious. All of which reveals an inner truth about the skill of reaching out to others. Those who are best at it don't network. They make friends. They gain admirers and win trust precisely because their amicable overtures extend to everyone. A widening circle of influence is an unintended result, not a calculated aim. Graham's relationship with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, more than anyone, highlighted her flair for friendship qua friendship, as opposed to friendship for ulterior purposes. On the surface, the two seemed the unlikeliest of pals. After all, the crucial moments of Graham's career were stunning blows to Kissinger's. First, in 1971, there was Graham's decision to publish the Pentagon Papers, confidential documents detailing the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. A year later, the Post, at Graham's behest, began its Watergate investigations. Both led to the embarrassment of the Nixon administration, in which Kissinger served. Yet there was Kissinger, the first speaker to eulogize Graham at her funeral. He and Graham frequently attended movies together. How did Graham form such an alliance, such a friendship? How did she create connections with everyone from anonymous teachers to the world's most famous and powerful? By knowing her boundaries and cultivating trust in others, by being discreet, by the sincerity of her intentions, by letting the other person know she had his or her best interests at heart. In an interview with CNN, Kissinger remarked, "It was a strange relationship in the sense that her paper was on the opposite side from my views very often, but she never attempted to use our friendship for any benefit for her newspaper. She never asked me for special interviews or anything of that kind." Section 2. The Skill Set. Chapter 7. Do Your Homework. Robert H. Schuller wrote, "Spectacular achievement is always preceded by spectacular preparation." Whom you meet, how you meet them, and what they think of you afterward should not be left to chance. As Winston Churchill would tell us, preparation is, if not the key to genius, then at least the key to sounding like a genius. Before I meet with any new people I've been thinking of introducing myself to, I research who they are and what their business is. I find out what's important to them, their hobbies, challenges, goals, inside their business and out. Before the meeting, I generally prepare, or have my assistant prepare, a one-page synopsis on the person I'm about to meet. The only criterion for what should be included is that I want to know what this person is like as a human being, what he or she feels strongly about, and what his or her proudest achievements are. Sure, you should also be up to date on what's happening within the company of a person you want to establish a relationship with. Did the person have a good or bad quarter? Do they have a new product? Trust me, all people naturally care, generally above and beyond anything else, about what it is they do. If you're informed enough to step comfortably into their world and talk knowledgeably, their appreciation will be tangible. As William James wrote, "The deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated." These days, doing such research is easy. Here are a few places to start. The Internet. Be sure to check out the company's website. Use search engines like Google to check a person's affiliations. Going to a meeting without Googling someone is unacceptable. The Public Library, where you'll find books, periodicals, magazines, trade journals, etc. Check for articles written by or about the people you intend to meet. If there aren't any, read up on the person's industry or type of job. Most of this can be found online, too. Literature from the company's public relations department. Call and explain that you have a scheduled meeting and would like some background information. Annual reports. They'll give you a good idea of where a company is headed and what challenges and opportunities lie ahead. Setting out to know someone inevitably means understanding what their problems or needs are. At work, it may be their product line. But as you talk with the person, you'll also find out that perhaps their kids are hoping to land an internship, that they themselves have health issues, or they just want to cut strokes off their golf game. The point is, you have to reach beyond the abstract and get to someone as an individual. Find a way to become part of those things that are of most interest to them, and you will have found a way to become part of their life. Recently, I took part in a roundtable discussion sponsored by the Milken Institute's Global Conference in Los Angeles, an annual 3-day gathering that brings together the world's top thinkers and CEOs to work over global problems. There were 15 participants, each one an executive of a company far bigger than my own. In many settings, I probably wouldn't have been rubbing elbows with them, but because I had helped organize the conference, always an advantage, I was invited to participate. The events were planned with the CEO's tight schedule in mind. There was a brief mixer before the event to allow the participants to mingle and get to know one another. Then a panel discussion on the future of marketing, given the challenges facing big brands. Afterward, a short dinner. In other words, there was about a 3-hour window of opportunity where I could hope to establish a foundation for 1 or 2 relationships. A successful conference's agenda is always created to maximize the participants' time. My own goal at such conferences is to maximize the brief windows of opportunity I might get to become intimate with other interesting people I haven't met before. Food, I find, has a unique ability to facilitate conversation. People are usually open, even eager, to be amused while eating. Meals at conventions, however, are problematic. They're rushed, frenetic affairs that call for gracious but unobtrusive small talk. You're never sure where you'll end up sitting. And among strangers, it's usually difficult to focus beyond the people sitting either to your left or right. And during the panel, people are focused on their own presentations. That left the mixer. During mixers, I like to hang out near the bar. Virtually everyone gets a drink at some point. Throughout the day, I had also scouted out which rooms the people I wanted to meet were holding court in for the day.